the message I'd like particularly people to understand here is that we did produce enough calories to extinguish hunger in the world. There's no question about it. Now, did we do it? No. And so the reason I'm spending time in front of you this afternoon is to argue that this is not an issue of caloric famine, that is to say, adequate supplies of food. It's an issue of economic famine. That is to say, it's not the lack of ability to feed people, but it's the lack of willingness and a commitment to doing so. So this is most emphatically not a supply problem. It's a lack of purchasing power to pay for a diet. It is also a problem of the economic capacity to put price and enough price into the agricultural system to make agriculture sustainable. From our perspective, it is absolutely true, and we heard the debate this morning, water is important, soil is important, seed is important, agronomy is important, and particularly for this audience with my colleagues from BSF, technology is important. But the really important element and the fundamental ingredient of sustainable agriculture is an adequate price to reward the farmer for her efforts to provide enough money so that she can repeat them again the following year. That's, for us, the big take-home message. So our perspective, and it reflects the optimism we heard this morning on the panel, is that, yes, we can raise agricultural production and get it to the people who need it. One of the reasons for this optimism is our performance over the last 35 years, where if you look at the production and productivity figures, we've essentially increased the production of the big 16 food crops that underpin the world's food agriculture and system by approximately 100%, and yet it's been done with roughly the same land under cultivation. However, I would just make one pause here. As I said, this is complex. Just be cautious about people who suggest one size fits all, and I'll come on to some of the dangers of that in just a moment. However, let me, if I may, leave you with an interesting quandary. There are some nuances, particularly some rural sociology nuances we need to consider. So are we trying to feed the world as fast as possible? Or are we trying to do it in a manner that's consistent with the current realities of the countries, particularly in the developing world, that they as well confront? We could make a good case that if Africa just wanted to feed itself, then large-scale farming would be one way to do it. My problem is, and this is the first of my perils, is that if you did that, you'd be very quickly confronted with a rural sociology problem, which to some extent you actually see in China today. That is, an enormous rural to urban migration. So in order to avoid this, and in order to avoid destabilizing countries where this takes place, we have the challenge of keeping smallholders on the land and on the farm, despite the fact that they are not the lowest cost producers, at least at the moment. So consequently, the challenge the world faces is this. There is a premium to be paid to keep smallholders on the land. Who is going to pay it? If the smallholders pay it, there's no motivation for them to stay on the land. If the urban population pays it, then that's going to be an imposition on them. And so how are we going to alleviate this particular burden? And what alternative funding mechanisms are to allow smallholders to succeed? In particular, how best can we ensure smallholders improve their productivity and therefore reduce the average cost of the crops they produce? So one of the big challenges for everybody in this arena is not simply to say, well, we need GM crops in Mozambique or Angola or wherever it may be, but to think very carefully, how, working with smallholders, are you going to improve their productivity? And the way you do that is going to be fundamentally different to the way that technology has been adopted in places like the US and in other developed economies. Now, I've mentioned the smallholder. What is it we think they need? Firstly, and there's been reference to this already, they need training in agricultural best practices. That is to say, and I heard it on the panel, we need to make sure that the best practices move around. And I think Fred Luckey mentioned that, you know, this is one of the roles of multinational organizations, and he's absolutely correct. We see it as one of our responsibilities and one of our obligations, and I'll explain why in just a moment. And they need access to other things as well, though. They need access to inputs. We've heard the impact a number of inputs from BSF have made to various crops and farms this morning. They need access to credit. They need access to storage to make sure that the crop they produce doesn't perish or doesn't break down. And they certainly need access to technology to increase their productivity in a sustainable way. That will obviously raise their own standards of living and also help them educate their children. But it also gives them surplus to help nourish other people, either directly in the countries they manufacture or in some cases for export. The second thing they need is revenue certainty, since they're often forced to sell at harvest when they are actually cash flow destitute and have limited access to real credit. Selling at depressed prices obviously creates a cycle discouraging further production in future years. And so from our perspective, farmers in developing countries need reliable markets into which they can sell their crops each season and receive an adequate price for their efforts and can provide the incentive to allow them to continue to do so. In addition, they need access to crop insurance and other risk management tools so they can rebound from crop failures caused by droughts or floods or other agricultural and seasonal fluctuations. The next and increasingly important area that they need is the ability to own the land and to pledge it as collateral if they are expected to invest in their farm and to raise its productivity. And, you know probably better than I do that a not insignificant source of instability in the Arab Spring was the lack of ownership by smallholder farmers in terms of their farms. And then last, and by no means least, they need access to markets. And we can provide access to markets, but to provide that access to markets, there needs to be some infrastructure. Infrastructure in transportation, infrastructure in distribution, storage and energy, as well as stable governments in legal and business structures to encourage investment. So, nice words. So what are we doing? From Cargill's perspective, as an example, in Vietnam, we've trained farmers on how to grow sustainable cocoa. And we will train more than 25,000 farms this year in the Ivory Coast to, in a similar way, to gain certification from worldwide organizations promoting sustainable agriculture. Now, yes, it means that sustainable agricultural practice is becoming an entree into the market. Without it, you can't sell your produce. But it also, coincidentally, of course, has productivity benefits. In our particular case, 30% in the Ivory Coast. We also, as an example, have trained more than 2 million farmers in the last year in areas of animal nutrition, sanitation, genetics, and farm management. That's 20 courses a day. So we're clearly quite busy. Now, it would be odd for me, speaking as I do as a representing Cargill, not to say a little bit about our commodity prices, where, of course, we are in a period of high historic volatility. And the continual volatility, as well as some of the price rises, in our view, are a reflection of a continuous state of disequilibrium between supply and demand. So, concrete example, in the drought in Russia a couple of years ago, when they faced a challenge and they decided that they would ban exports, that actually reduced the global production of grain by 0.7%. And yet that reduction resulted in price increases of 60 to 80% of all grains. So clearly, modest changes in supply have big impact in terms of prices. Now, one of the reasons for this, and this is where I move on to my next peril and probably one of the big challenges of all, is the disequilibrium is due to, in our view, the world stocks-to-use ratio. Now, we follow this number extremely closely. And what happens if you take the stocks-to-use ratio and you multiply by 365 days... you get a sense of what the stocks are over a year and how close we are living to the edge. Now, if you were to look back between the years, say, 1980s and 2003, then we operated as a world with fairly robust stocks. And as a result, we had relatively muted price volatility. However, this was probably a period where the Western world did more harm to sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia than any other period in history. So why do I say this? I say this very simply, because the subsidies we were providing in these countries masked the signal of price to farmers in both Western Europe and the United States to produce less through slowing down or stopping planting and to taking marginal land out of production. We continued to produce, and as a result, the price of grains fell way below the ability of any smallholder even to compete. Now, having wiped the smallholders out, they were then grain deficient. So we then exported these surpluses to developing countries, who in turn saw no interest in and no return on investing in their own agriculture for several decades. So it has clearly been a depressing spiral. The point of my bringing this uncomfortable fact to this audience is that the behaviour of governments and farmers in one geography through the interconnected world we currently live in has an enormous impact on the investment decisions and the fate and well-being of people in other geographies. One of the things that we continually emphasise in our conversations is the power of price. Now, for some people, price increases of foodstuffs is a harbinger of inflation and something not welcome. We see it as in a somewhat different light. First of all, we've used some of the drivers of higher prices to be good. Things such as the increase in per capita income and the capacity of more people to have a nutritious diet. Now, we witness every day throughout Cargill, in actual fact, that price is a signal to farmers to do something and what we want them to do, which is namely to produce more. What we find is that countries that intervene, and of course the United States, Western Europe, most of the Northern Hemisphere are cases in point, countries that intervene through subsidies, tariffs, mandates, trade restrictions, fail to send that encouragement to farmers with often perilous results to the long-term competitive character of the farmers in those countries. One example, which is probably non-contentious because it's not the United States or Europe, is the example of Argentina. The government imposed a price and export control on beef when prices started to go up 4 or 5 years ago. Now, the size of the beef herd in Argentina has dropped by 25%. In other words, there was a strong price message to farmers. The price message was not to invest and not to produce. So remember, we need to be mindful that the burden on the world's poor as price rises is certainly something to be considered. But there are positive outcomes in terms of increasing production and signalling the world producers to plant more. From our perspective, in the old adage, the cure for high prices is high prices. Now, another thing which also puts us on in the unpopularity bracket is that in times of volatility, we want to remind people of comparative advantage. Our perspective is that if every country on Earth tried to pursue self-sufficiency in food, there will be less food in the world because we're not all equally endowed by climate, by soil, by water, and by other infrastructure possibilities. We could, as another perilous example, in Minnesota, which is where I'm based, grow enough and produce enough orange juice to supply all of Minnesota and probably most of the Midwest. Now, for those of you who may not be familiar with Minnesota, the city where I'm based in Minneapolis is the coldest large city in North America. The winter temperatures are minus 20 degrees centigrade during the day, and the ice in the lakes is a meter thick. Now, we could do it, but we should not do so, because it would be a complete distortion of the issues of comparative advantage. So Minnesota does have some comparative advantages, reflected in broadacre crops such as corn and soybeans. But it also applies beyond just energy. So one of other example, as many of you be aware, is that some time ago Saudi Arabia made a decision to back away from irrigated wheat production, which accounted for 85% of their water use. That is to say, 15% of their water use was for other industries, and for including oil, and for their own domestic purposes. Just by making this decision, they extended the life cycle of their aquifer by ninefold. And it gives them then the opportunity to invest in places like Sudan, which is obviously rain-fed. And as a consequence, we get the advantages of comparative. We get the benefits of comparative advantage. Now, we feel that open markets are the best way of providing access to both locally and globally sourced food. And it's the best way to meet their nutritional needs. There are, however, my fourth peril example, consequences of taking some of the thoughts in the locavore and food miles movement to extremes. It's often overlooked that the largest single use of hydrocarbons is in transporting food from your home, from your grocery store to your home. As an example, it takes Cargill and other producers 4 litres of fuel to transport a tonne of grain 4,000 kilometres in an ocean-going vessel. If you brought home 40 kilos of food on every trip to a grocery store 6 kilometres from your house, you would burn 10 times as much, 40 litres of gasoline per tonne of food. With that amount of food, you could send grain several times around the world. So focusing largely on food miles and exclusively on food miles can lead us to the wrong decisions. Furthermore, by not planting the right crops in the right soil with the right climate, we end up using more land, therefore less land for wildlife refuges and less land for recreation, less land for set-aside. For a similar reason, we do not see organic farming on a large scale as a major contributor to food security, as its use would require us to significantly increase the amount of land we farm and to feed our population with all the deleterious consequences on the environment. Now, having dissed a number of what are currently favourites in some quarters, let me speak about an area where we do see a lot of opportunity. What I can say will be a major contributor to food security in the future is the adoption of the technologies we've heard about here this morning from BSF. We strongly believe in Cargill that the adoption of new crop varieties, in some cases either GM crop varieties or at least mark-resistant selected developed varieties, is going to be important in feeding the world. In fact, as a consequence of that, we were the first company in the world to actually ship GM crops from, in this particular case, the US, for export. Now, finally, and you'll expect this from Cargill again, open markets play a key role in ensuring food security. The ability to harvest the advantages, pun intended, of comparative advantage depends on the capacity to have open, trust-free trade. As a consequence, Cargill opposes all mandates and subsidies in general, and in biofuels made from food crops in particular, as they increase, they create inelastic demand and increase volatility in the food system. We do believe that there can be an appropriately sized biofuels industry, because as far as we're concerned, it is just one more way of harvesting photosynthesis. However, and this is my last example of perilous consequences, if biofuel production reaches the scale that's being talked about today, spurred on by government mandates and subsidies, we think it will affect the supply and demand for food crops. As a consequence, it can be troublesome for the world's food system and especially for land use, and it will have a deleterious impact on people with lower incomes around the world. So, in summary, let me just, if I may, revisit some of the key elements that we believe are important for food security. Firstly, the ability to understand the trade-offs between a fast path to caloric sufficiency through scale farming on the one hand and the needs of rural sociology and smallholders on the other. Secondly, the crops must be grown in the right soil with the right technology and relying on free trade so that we can harvest comparative advantage to its fullest. Thirdly, it is crucially important for property rights to be clarified so that we're going to get working capital necessary to increase further investment in agriculture. Fourth, smallholders in developing countries need some degree of revenue certainty if we expect them to do what the countries really need them to do, which is raise productivity. Fifth, increased food security requires trust-based open trade that is open and facilitated by all. From our perspective, the private sector has a role, but it's not an exclusive role. It needs to be complemented by both public, private, and philanthropic partnerships, of which we have a number of examples. And then finally, and very important, we believe that the world's governments do need to reinvest in the creation of infrastructure to provide access to markets. So the message from us is we believe that innovation in sustainability and sustainability itself is a means to an end. And that end is the end of providing food security for the world as a whole. Thank you very much, and good afternoon.